May it please the court. My name is Lawrence Coco. I'm here on behalf of appellant James Smith. We are here, Your Honor, appealing Mr. Smith's conviction under 18 U.S.C. 1001, which makes it a crime to make a misstatement of material fact to a branch of the United States government. Specifically, the appeal centers on the fact that the alleged false statements made by Mr. Smith do not have a sufficient federal nexus with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration and the program promulgated by it, the CDLIS program, which is the Commercial Driver's License Information System program, sufficient to convey jurisdiction or satisfy the requirements of materiality. There is not a Fifth Circuit or United States Supreme Court case addressing fraudulent statements as they're made to the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration and the CDLIS program. However, there are a Sixth and Ninth Circuit cases that the appellant believes provides very persuasive authority in programs that are very similar to the program administered by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Specifically in the Holmes and Ficini cases, which are the Sixth and Ninth Circuit cases, they dealt with employment programs that were put in place by the Department of Labor, where the Department of Labor essentially administered these employment benefits programs, but did not provide any benefits to the state. They obviously had access to the information, but they took no action as it related to such information. And in those situations, those courts held that mere access to information was not sufficient to convey jurisdiction between fraudulent statements to get benefits and the Department of Labor. Based on this, we believe that Mr.
Now, when you say access to information, who has access to what? What is it you're talking about?
Are you talking about in this particular case, Your Honor?
In this case.
In this case, it is the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has got a program called the Commercial Driver's License Information System. This program essentially connects the 50 states so that each state has information. Access of drivers' information, and in particular, it relates to commercial drivers. The situation in this case is that program is actually administered by the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. It's a third-party administrator. It's made up of all the licensing agencies of the 50 states. This is the entity that actually runs the program. The information is put by the specific states, and the states actually fund the AAMVA, which is referred to as AMVA. They actually fund AMVA via a yearly fee, and they in turn fund the CDLIS program. And the information from the 50 states regarding driving records is inputted into the CDLIS system, which, again, all the states can access. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration doesn't take any action as it relates to this information. It's simply accessible to them and all the other 50 states. The enforcement of traffic tickets is done by the respective states. Suspensions that might relate from those tickets are done by the 50 states. Any action that would generate from a ticket is taken by the state itself. And in fact, in the record, Mr. Timothy Smith, a member of a lawyer for the Mississippi Department of Public Safety, stated that the state of Mississippi was the final arbiter in terms of enforcing its laws. As it relates to the American AMVA, this is a group of licensing agencies that runs the CDLIS program, and it provides the training for the CDLIS program. It provides the implementation of the program. It promulgates the procedures for the program. It is the body that actually does it. Now, certainly, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has access to the information, but they don't actually do any functions as it relates to the information. And as it relates to the applicable law, as it interpreting 1001, there are two requirements, jurisdiction and a materiality as to the false statement. They're very closely intertwined ideas, but simply put, jurisdiction is it does the false statement have the ability to impact or affect a decision or an authorized function made by the government agency? And it can't be something that's peripheral to the body. It's got to be something that's directly connected. And the Sixth, and that's law that's consistent in the Supreme Court and in the Fifth Circuit. Now, the Sixth and Ninth Circuits have taken it a step further, when they were faced with programs that dealt with situations where an agency had access to the information, and they said mere access to information is not sufficient to convey jurisdiction. There has to be an actual direct connection for there to be jurisdiction and a sufficient federal nexus. And the reason for this is because we don't want to have the scope of 1001 to be unlimited. And if it were allowed that if the government had access to information and by virtue of some government body, if that alone were allowed to create jurisdiction, it would make the jurisdiction virtually limitless. And they wanted to make sure that there were confines placed on 1001.
So what do you do with the Taylor case?
Your Honor, the Taylor case is very distinguishable from the instant facts, because in that case it was a situation where you had HUD was providing Katrina funds to the Mississippi Development Authority. And the benefits were actually going from HUD to the Mississippi Development Authority and going to applicants for those benefits. And in that case, you had a situation where a beneficiary was making fraudulent applications for these benefits, and HUD actually had the power to rescind the benefits. And in fact, in looking at the program, if they felt like the program wasn't being run appropriately, they could actually rescind all of the benefit funds entirely. And so in that case, it was a situation where HUD actually had power and could take direct action relative to the false statements. It's completely distinguishable from the instant case where the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration doesn't take any action as it relates to the false statements. And again, as it relates to Ficini and Holmes, the Ninth and Sixth Circuit cases, and I'll deal with them together because the facts are very closely intertwined, it was a situation where the Department of Labor was essentially implementing these employment benefits programs for the states of Oregon and Michigan, respectively. And the Department of Labor maintained the ability to audit and look at the program and make sure that it was being run properly, but they weren't providing any of the benefits to the specific beneficiaries. And in both of those cases, persons were convicted under 1001 for making fraudulent statements in an attempt to get benefits. And both of the courts said mere access to information by the Department of Labor was not enough to convey jurisdiction. And in fact, they said the fact that there was an audit done to examine the program.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. Why would this defendant go to the trouble of making these little entries changes, which all of which hide the driving records, serious defects in the driving histories of these particular individuals? If the effect of that was not to prevent them from being discovered by regulatory authorities, which also include the feds.
Your Honor, if I understand your question, the reason for doing it in this instance was they were improper suspensions that had taken place on the license, and Mr. Smith was attempting to change, and the problem was that there were
Well, you don't contest that the entries were false.
No, well, Your Honor, I don't contest that the entries were certainly made. And for purposes of this, I mean, for purposes of the appeal and the argument,
did you try the case?
No, Your Honor, I did not. Okay. I did not.
But did counsel at trial challenge the falsity of the entries?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
Okay, so we start with the proposition that the man accesses these records and makes false entries and to the benefit of these over-the-road commercial drivers, which keeps them on the road. And you have a national network of among all 48 states that they're into this program. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I believe this. I believe the testimony in the record was that all the states.
Well, all the states. Yes. Well, we can add two more in there, I guess. I wouldn't worry about Hawaii at the moment. But we have basically everybody signed up to this program. Now, why do you suppose that's the case?
Well, Your Honor, certainly it's to allow the states to have all of the respective states to have access to the information.
Okay.
But again, the issue is that there's no action being taken by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration relative to the information that's being provided by Mr. Smith. Certainly,
What was the action that was being taken by HUD and Taylor?
There was no action taken by them either because there were no benefits being provided. I'm sorry, in Taylor, I apologize. In Taylor, they took away the benefits. They took away the benefits being provided to the beneficiary, and they actually had the right to suspend the entire relief program if they felt like it wasn't being administered properly. That's not the case.
Well, HUD's overarching responsibility was simply to dole out the money, right?
Well, but what they maintained in Taylor, they maintained the authority to evaluate the submissions and the applications being made, and if they felt like that they were being made improperly or there was some problem with it, that they could rescind the funds. And they actually had the right in Taylor to take away the funds that were being doled out and rescind the program entirely.
Let me ask you a question. You have a 18-wheeler come rolling through Jackson at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the driver just goes to sleep. And he crashes into another car. People are injured, killed. And the state patrol then comes, and the driver's unhurt. And they look at the records, and they dial in the computer. What records can they access? Would it be useful for them to know that this guy has done this 3 times before?
Certainly, Your Honor. Certainly, and.
Well, that's the purpose of all this, isn't it, is to keep these guys off the road. And I made that because the only way you do that is by providing information available to all the law enforcement agencies, and not just in one single state, but throughout the country, because there are interstate drivers, right?
Certainly. Yes, Your Honor.
So that somebody that's making false entries in the state is frustrating the entire this communication network.
Yes, Your Honor, but they are not impeding the function that is taking place of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, because it doesn't invalidate the program. The program's still valid. It's still working. The action that takes place of the fraudulent statements that take place, they don't have any connection with something that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration does. Again, it's regulated by AMVA. And they're the ones that do the procedures. They're the ones that do that provide the training. And the states themselves are the ones that if you have this fraudulent information, they're the ones that are going to actually.
So Federal Motor Carrier does not suspend or anyone at all. It's only this private this third party intra-government state group that does that. Is that right?
Actually, Your Honor, the neither one.
The state does.
The individual
states do it based upon the recommendation of the intra-state group.
Not even the recommendation, based on the procedures that are promulgated, and they have to be incorporated into state law.
Okay.
So you have the federal regulations that are, and frankly, the federal regulations are all based on AMVA's procedures. I mean, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration doesn't even promulgate the regulations. They just adopt what AMVA puts into place, but the states have to adopt those regulations into their code. And in fact, again, Mr. Timothy Smith, who is a Mississippi Department of Transportation individual, he stated that if there's a conflict between the regs and state law controls. So it's the states retain that power.
I think Judge Hickenbotham may have another question. I didn't mean to.
Certainly.
Counsel, what do you do with the language in Taylor which says that a false statement may fall, and this is a quote, within the jurisdiction of a federal agency, even if the agency lacks the authority to act on that statement, so long as the statement has the potential to contravene the intent of an agency program?
Well, Your Honor, I would state that, again, that the language itself, it doesn't have these false statements don't have the power to contravene the intent of the program because they don't suspend the program. They don't suspend the program. They don't affect the validity of the program.
Okay. HUD had no direct authority over the disbursement of the funds in Taylor, no power to punish the fraudulent claims.
Your Honor, I believe that in Taylor, HUD actually did have the power to rescind the funds if they were provided in that situation. My recollection of Taylor was that if HUD determined that they actually had the authority to cease funding the program and require MDA to refund the money if HUD determined that the MDA was administering the money in violation of HUD guidelines, and that's it in Taylor at 562. So they did maintain the ability to affect the funds that were going to the Mississippi Development Authority and rescind those if the program wasn't being administered properly. That's not the case in this case. I see my time has expired, unless the court has additional questions.
Yes, you've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you, Dr. Cooper. Mr. Cleveland?
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. Gaines Cleveland for the government. James Smith's falsification of commercial driving records was within the jurisdiction of the U.S. Department of Transportation, which is charged with promoting driver safety of commercial truckers. Smith's actions as director of Mississippi Driver Records served to conceal driver records that federal law required be disclosed and kept commercial drivers on the road who would otherwise have been suspended. The applicable federal statute refers to safety as the highest priority of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. That's from 49 U.S.C. 113B. Agency witness Robert Redman testified that the National Commercial Driver's License Program was created by Congress because of growing public concern over the safety of the nation's highways. That's in the transcript at 52. By federal law, each state is required to, quote, maintain a record of each violation of a traffic control law for each individual who holds a commercial driver's license. That's from 49 U.S.C. 3113.11a.18. So the integrity of the commercial driving records is plainly a matter within the jurisdiction of the U.S. Department of Transportation. The commercial driver's license information system is far different from the Department of Labor's relationship to state unemployment benefit programs at issue in Ficini and Holmes, the Ninth and Sixth Circuit cases that the defendant cites. Both involved fraudulent claims for unemployment benefits. Ficini involved both a state and a federal program and upheld the federally funded program. The key to those decisions as to the state-funded programs was there was no federal stake in the fraudulent claims for state benefits. Here, by contrast, Congress has recognized there's a national interest in highway safety that Smith's false statements serve to undermine. There's a federal interest in the integrity of what's reported as part of the CDL program. Another key distinction is the absence of federal regulatory authority over the state unemployment programs in Ficini and Holmes. Here, on the other hand, the federal agency, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, is authorized. It's authorized to withhold federal funds as provided in 49 CFR 384.401. This contrasts with Ficini, where the court noted that the Secretary of Labor does not have the authority to withhold funds. In addition,
is that the test? Where is the limit to this? The federal government is more broadly involved in all aspects of our lives. If any kind of representation that's made to a state or local group, if they could come in and say, well, that affects this agency, this, that, the other, is the test whether or not it has the ability to affect federal funds?
It doesn't have to involve funds, and that's an important distinction between this case. There's a federal interest in driver safety of commercial truckers.
But there's a federal interest in almost everything. How do we avoid making this very broad statute applicable to any local misrepresentation? Where's the line?
Congress has already defined this program in Title 49, and the agency has implemented what Congress wanted in the regulations found in Title 49. There's a very specific set of requirements on the part of the states who participate in this national program of sharing commercial driver's license information, very important for the safety of our highways, and there are very specific items of information that have to be reported. And it's that category of information that Mr. Smith manipulated in this case to keep commercial truckers on the road. It's a very important safety feature, and there is a very strong national interest. This is not an intrusion of the federal government into an area that's somewhere isolated in the country. This is we have an interstate highway network. Truckers are out there competing with regular drivers every day, and there's a strong national interest in making sure that the driver records are accurate.
Does the government agree with the lines drawn by the Sixth and Ninth Circuit to say that those programs did not qualify under the statute?
The key distinction, there were two programs, for example, issued in Ficini. One involved federal funds. It was a 26-month program, a federally funded program, and there was a federal interest there because federal money was at stake. The state programs that were issued in Ficini and Holmes were state-funded programs, and there was federal money to administer those programs. Those cases have been criticized, and I don't think we need to go so far as to really address the merits of those cases because the
Well, that's why I asked you for earlier. Is it the federal funds that make the distinction? What is the distinction that you would find cognizable? Where's your line? Where's the government's line?
This program...
I'm not asking how this one satisfies it. You've already explained that. I'm asking when would it not satisfy it? What's the circumstance where you would envision that it would not satisfy it?
When there's not a federal interest. And the case law talks about jurisdiction being not given a narrow meaning for purposes of 1001. That's from the Rogers decision of the Supreme Court, 466 U.S. at 480.
Can you envision a circumstance where there is not a federal interest?
Oh, sure. There.
Can you give me an example?
Well,
of a state government function that doesn't impact some federal interest.
Something that does not cross interstate lines. You've got a not real trucks, but trucks that children go and play on, maybe at a park. I don't know what regulations cover those, but there's got to be obviously a federal interest in it to have. Here we've got an interest in public safety for the nation's highways.
Was the government's theory that the defendant and the appellant engaged in these acts to help his buddies? Is that because he didn't get any money? There's no allegation that he was on the take or something,
right.
Correct?
This is basically a product, I think, of a sort of good old boy network in Mississippi, but at a level where it was having an impact on commercial truckers. And it has an impact on people outside of the state, and the people outside of the state have an interest in making sure that states, that sometimes in a good old boy network, takes hold, that doesn't affect the safety of people who are having to encounter those drivers out on the highways.
Was it the defendant appellant's position that these changes were all made to the extent that he acknowledged some of the changes he denied making, but the ones that he did were pursuant to some kind of integrity of the data issue with the computer system? Was that the defense? I'm unclear on that.
It was really muddled at the trial. They called a fellow with the public safety, a lawyer with involved in the public safety, and his experience was in the keeping drunk drivers off the road, and he had a concern about the way the statutes, Mississippi laws, were interplaying with the federal guidance on drunk drivers. He did not have very much information about speeding violations. Speeding violations are plainly covered under, at that time, Mississippi Code Section 63-175, which defines a serious traffic violation as including excessive speeding involving a charge of any speed 15 miles per hour over the posted speed limit. When operating a motor vehicle, it doesn't make a distinction between your own personal vehicle or a commercial motor vehicle at that time, and that was muddled by the defense. But in any good faith that was advanced at the time of trial is not at issue on appeal. So let me address a couple of points. Let's get back to the authority of the federal agency. It did have the authority to decertify the entire commercial driver's license program of the state. That is at 49 CFR 394.405, which is an important distinction from the Ficini and Holmes cases in that area. The fact that this federal agency has chosen to administer this program through a network of states and this nonprofit entity, that doesn't take it outside of the agency's jurisdiction. This court has recognized that false statements made to need not be made directly to a federal agency in order to fall within the statute. And Mr. Smith says the false statements are not within the agency's jurisdiction because the agency doesn't take action related to a specific holder of a commercial driver's license. Well, the federal government does not need to come in and supplant the entire state and local law enforcement of traffic laws for there to be a federal interest in the integrity of driving records. We would argue the statements were material as well. That was not a point developed during the oral argument, but the actions taken by this defendant did go to a government function that was ensuring the purpose of which was ensuring accuracy of driving records for commercial driving drivers. Even in the Godin test, which was not developed.
Let me ask you a question. How would this kind of a local falsifying of records come to the attention of the Fed?
This, as I understand it, I think this is beyond the record, but there was someone who...
My question really goes to the kind of regulatory scope and how this... How would it come to the attention of the Feds?
There is under the federal regulations and the federal statute, there are periodic audits that are done at the state. Okay, you've got and there are minimum standards for compliance for the state in order to be able to continue to participate in the program, not lose federal funds, to not be decertified, and one of the criteria is that the records be accurately reported.
Now, who is doing the audit?
The audit is done by the Federal Motor Carrier Administration. And there were a couple of audits that were referred to during the course of the
trial. So what you have is the Fed's auditing a program, and then the records they're going to be auditing have been falsified.
That's right. Now these
is that how these came to light, or were these from tips?
These were from tips. This was
this
not
was not from the audit right. process that these That's were right. discovered. These were that, from tips. Right. Somebody said he's helping his buddies.
In essence, it was not as a result of the audit, the most important thing. But obviously, it could have been picked up in the audit. There's power, the power, the authority of the federal government to act. It's really the key point.
Well, I ask how it would be picked up in the audit for the ones revolving Rawls, Parker, and Davis? Because those didn't change the code that the federal government would note. So how in the world would that be picked up in the audit?
That's actually not accurate. If you look at the way that the records were maintained. The tickets are actually written up in Mississippi. Exhibit six has a whole series of sub-exhibits related to this, but one of them is the ticket itself, and it has there where you check off S92 speeding, but then above that it has the speed and the zone. So the officer is required to indicate. For example, in the case of Mr. Parker, 81 in a 65, and that appears on the face of the ticket. That then goes into the database that the state maintains. And then when somebody comes behind, such as Mr. Smith did, and changes the record, it's in the record. It's in the audit trail. So, for example, in count one, Robert Rawls was going 82 in a 65 in a Kenworth truck. Mr. Smith came along and reduced that to 72 and a 65, and that would have been this Rawls' third such ticket. In the case of count two, Larry Parker was going 81 in a 65, and Smith reduced that to 71 in a 65, and he removed the suspension code. Delmaine Davis, that was 40 in a 25, and Smith reduced that to 35 in a 25, and that would have been the third such ticket. The effect of each was to avoid the suspension that's required by 49 CFR.
But this didn't change their S92 codes, did it?
The S92 code is, Mississippi has adopted the S92 code sort of format. That requires that you list the actual speed. So that is a core element of the information that's required to be maintained as part of the database.
But no decisions made if it's...
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The individual... speed is not relevant to the monitoring that's done under the...
It's actually, as the testimony is, that it's an integral part.
Okay. On the end, when you do S-92?
S-92, the way Mississippi has approached this, it has to be associated with the specific traffic, the speed violation.
Okay.
And
thank you.
Yeah, that's...
So your argument, in essence, is that there are other things that government has the power, and this program has the power to conduct audits, and what you have is a falsification of the documents which they have the power to offer, and hence that surely is within the compass of 1001.
That's correct.
And inside of Taylor.
That's correct.
That's the essence of your argument.
That is, yeah. Okay.
Well, I thought you were also saying earlier, maybe I misunderstood you, I thought you were also saying earlier that there's an obvious federal interest in highway safety, and that to the extent that drivers who otherwise would be suspended are not suspended, that undermines the fundamental purpose of the program.
Right. That's as well. I didn't know that there was a tension between the two. I was that's true as well, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cleveland. Mr. Coco, you've saved time for rebuttal.
You know, first, I'd like to respond to an interest is not enough. It has to be related to a federal function that is taking place. And the fact that there's an interest there, I mean, the federal government has an interest in almost everything. And so the fact that they've got an interest in something doesn't create the federal jurisdiction under 1001. And that goes back to making sure that the reach of 1001 is not limitless. I mean, and so that's one distinction I'd like to make. As it relates to this core information,
well,
it's
pretty obvious that under at least a lot of other statutes, the federal government is quite active in the field of vehicle safety, whether it's requirements for how vehicles are manufactured or whether it's funding statutes that provide states with benefits if they have certain DWI laws, or I mean, there's a whole range. I'm sure there are many more than the ones that I've mentioned. If that's so, then anything that undermines providing accurate information to this under this federal program, it seems to me, undermines all those other programs because it makes it more difficult to obtain accurate information nationwide as to traffic problems and issues that might need to be addressed by the federal government in other areas, such as vehicle safety.
And again, Your Honor, I don't dispute that there's an interest there. My submission would be that the interest is not enough, that there must be something that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration does in relation to the false statements that would impact their functions. And I want to...
About the audit function?
Your Honor?
What about audit function?
The audit situation is, the record is very clear that the audits were not necessarily auditing the types of statements that Mr. Smith were making, but it was auditing the computer procedures, the procedures in place for the CDLIS system. It wasn't going in and capturing what Mr. Smith may or may not have said.
Well, they'd be interested in the computer program's ability to capture, but have no interest in what to capture.
Well, again, Your Honor, it's a situation where the record at trial was that these computer programs and the systems and how they brought in the information and how it was coded and whatnot, but it wasn't, the audits weren't designed to catch.
I thought, counsel, that was to gain uniformity in record production and maintenance, in part.
Are you talking about the audits, Your Honor?
The computer programming and the interest in those was to try to gather data in a way that it can be mined by others, and that is a uniformity of retention.
Certainly, Your Honor, and there was that goal, but it wasn't to go and find individual persons' false statements that were taking place. And I do want to respond to one point on the core information. The D-17 at 140, which is a defense exhibit, it very clearly states that the core information is the code. It does, and as you look at that document, it says the speed is is voluntary. It's a recommended, but it's not something that you had to do. And that's what would show up on the deal. And so it was the requisite information. So we stand by the statement that the core information that was required by the CDLS wasn't changed. However, it doesn't matter in that it didn't affect a function. And if I could close with this, is that Mr. Smith was making these changes as a result of policy to make sure that persons who were convicted of driving personal vehicles didn't have their license suspended when the rule was that you get a suspension if you have two excessive driving infractions in a commercial vehicle. This was the policy that they, as the state entity, the Department of Transportation, came up with of changing the speeds to make sure that suspensions that were being captured by the CDLIS weren't improperly done. And the reason why I bring that up is because it goes to the fact that this type of procedure shouldn't be something that implicates what I would call the danger of limitless application of 1001. It's a situation where it was something that was being done by the state, handled by the state, and it just didn't impact something that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration was going to do. And so I would submit that Mr. Smith's conviction, there is not a sufficient federal nexus to his false statements and the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and we respectfully request that his conviction be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Coker, your case is under submission. We noticed that you're court appointed, and we want to